Hi, I'm Sam Cedar.
And I'm Emma Vigeland. This week on Ring of Fire, Matthew Stieb of New York Magazine joins me to discuss New York's recently passed cannabis legalization law, where it succeeds and where it falls short.
And Heather Digby Parton will help me run down the biggest stories of the week like she does every week. Become a member of this podcast over at ROFpodcast.com. It is your support that keeps this show going. And today, as a bonus interview, you will hear an interview I did with Alexander Zaitchek on Bill Gates' role in ensuring that it was profits over lives when it comes to vaccinating the world. So check that out. Just do so by becoming a member over at ROFpodcast.com. Here to break down this week's news, Heather Digby Parton from Salon and the popular blog Hullabaloo. So, Heather, obviously the big story this week in the news was the verdict that was handed down in the murder case of Derek Chauvin. He is the former police officer charged with killing George Floyd. The Floyd protests, of course, were dominated last summer. Chauvin killed Floyd by basically shoving his knee into Floyd's neck, the back of his neck, while Floyd was subdued for 9 minutes, and just slowly driving that knee into his neck as the life literally drained out of George Floyd's body. And Chauvin was found guilty on three counts of two of murder and one of homicide. And he has yet to be sentenced. That's coming up. But there's every reason to believe that he's going to be spending many, many years in prison. This is a very rare happening. We don't have great statistics on how many people police have killed in any given year, because there's really no central clearinghouse. But, I've seen figures 1,000 a year or so. And over the past 2 decades, if we've had more than 5 or 6 police officers who killed someone on duty, I think that would be the upper end of that spectrum. I think it's about 5 or 6, maybe 7. I don't even know how to do the math on what kind of percentage that is. It's 0.0 something. And so this is a fairly rare occasion, but it's interesting the reaction that we saw from various sectors of our society. But before we get to all of that, let's just talk about your piece. You wrote a very thoughtful piece that was grounded in an event that I wonder how many people still really contemplate and think about. But it was one of the earliest example, and many people are crediting the woman who took the video of Chauvin killing Floyd with all of this. You know, the protest that took place last summer. And you wrote about maybe what was one of the first times that we saw a video of this type. And that was during the beating of Rodney King. Tell us about that.
Well, I was living in LA when the Rodney King beating was shown. I saw it that night on the local news. It was a guy who just happened to get a new camcorder, and he filmed this event. And it was 4 police officers brutally beating Rodney King, and while a whole bunch of cops stood around and watched. And there were other witnesses to it as well, who were in the same building. The guy's name was George Holliday, was his name. And he sold the video for $500 to a local TV station, who then gave it to CNN. It went around the world. And it was the first time, I think, we'd seen plenty of police beatings, but they were in the context of protests civil rights movement. I mean, think about that, you know, the fire hoses and, you know, the beatings that went on during the Vietnam protests and things like that. So it wasn't that we'd never seen police brutality before on film, but this was, they didn't know anybody was watching. This, that was there. It was kind of this idea that this is what happens when nobody's there. And this is what they do when they're, when they have the opportunity to do this. And of course, many, many victims, most of them Black, have complained about this for, you know, hundreds of years, basically. And this was the first time I think it had been documented in quite this sort of, you know, bird's eye view. So we watched this thing and the whole world watched it. And I don't know, you probably don't remember this, but because I don't think you're old enough, but those of us who are, you know, it was a, it, it was a massive worldwide, you know, raising of consciousness. I mean, people went, oh my God. And of course, they did end up arresting the four cops, and they put them on trial, and they had, they put the trial out in this certain, this enclave, suburban enclave outside of LA, where all the cops live, right? So everybody on the jury was tended to be neighbors with police officers, was not a, you know, a community where this had actually happened. And they put, the defense put on a case that I think sort of set the table for this, which was, look, you can't really believe your eyes. The video doesn't say what you think it says. You need, you know, and they slowed it down and they said, look, here's where he turned around and he looked up, you know, he got violent. And, you know, of course, when you manipulate videos, anybody who's in the business knows, you can make it look different than what it actually was. So they did that. And then there was the blue wall of silence came in completely. They backed up the police. All of the guys who were there said it was totally justified. I mean, there would, nobody broke with it. And of course, we know what happened. They, the jury found those cops not guilty, which still happens today over and over again. And we know that the town of, you know, the city of Los Angeles, it exploded. And we had some of the worst riots in American history after that verdict. And of course, those of us who lived here at the time, we can all remember what that was like. I mean, the whole town, I mean, it felt as if, and I thought at the time that this was going to be a sea change. I thought, you know, look, this is on video. We saw what happened, and the legal system refused to believe it. And they basically said, you can believe us or you can believe your eyes. And that jury let those cops off. So I've been thinking about that from the moment I saw the George Floyd video. Because to me, I'm going, okay, now this time, we're in a different time now. And video is something that we see, a video of these police incidents is something that we see all the time. Rarely do we see anything this horribly brutal and up close, right? I mean, the girl who videotaped that, one of the things that she did that was so amazing was she got in there and videotape that very close up, and we saw what happened and could see the looks on the on Chauvin's face and his colleagues there, and the look on George Floyd's face. I mean, it was horrifying. I mean, I've seen it dozens of times, as everybody has, and it's just as awful now as it was when we first saw it. But you know, I saw that and I thought, okay, has anything changed? Has something changed here? The fact that we've seen all these videos, the Black Lives Matter movement, which has been, was around before George Floyd. I mean, this was happening. Has anything, have we changed? And I was cynical, you know, I mean, I think a lot of us, we've been watching this stuff for so long and you feel like nothing ever changes. And so in my piece on in Salon, when I was reflecting on all that stuff, I kind of came away with it feeling, I mean, I didn't feel optimistic necessarily, but I felt the sense of relief that there has been, it's taken 30 years. There's no excuse for that. There has been some change. And one of the big changes was that, you know, I think we understand how to see these videos now. There's not, that no one can convince us of anything, you know, different now. And the police, they broke the blue wall of silence on this case. And they had police who testified in the trial in very compelling fashion. And the police force is a lot more diverse. You know, this that you've got, you know, some of the one of the police officers who's involved in this will come on trial later this summer is Asian American. You've got, you know, you had Black police chief that testified in extremely compellingly. That made a difference too. That's part of the difference. And then I was watching some of these videos of people around the country who gathered after the verdict. And one of them, they gathered at in LA, in South Central LA, at where the start, you know, of the LA riots were. And they had people, they were interviewing men on the street. And this man, they asked him, what do you think is different now than was there? And he said, well, the main difference I see, and it is different, is that I see a lot more Latino, Asian, and white people who are on our side. And I thought, that's meaningful, because it's a big country, you know. I mean, this being, you know, allyship means something, and, you know, it is meaningful. Not all by any means, certainly not all white people by any means, but more. And he felt, and he was a guy who'd been there. On that day, he'd been on the street. So, you know, I felt relief, and also I felt some hope, because a lot of the people who were out in the street, they felt relief, and they were saying, it's not over. This is just one first step. This is just, you know, we got to move. We've got our moment here, and we can, and being able, you know, if you're somebody, if you're an activist, or you're a, you know, you're just a you know, a Black American, and you've been through all this stuff, if you see the legal system working, even this one time, it gives you hope. And I think that's something that, you know, Black America needs right now. They have got to have some sense of hope. And this was, you know, just a small piece of hope for them. So,
I mean, that's interesting. I mean, I agree with that notion that it provides some hope. I have, it's impossible to have a jaded look at that ruling. I mean, from you know, I should say that I'm very happy about that ruling. Completely necessary. But also, I think one of the things that I found a little bit troubling about the response, at least from the mainstream world of thought, was that it was overinterpreted as something that had implications for the system that we live in.
Right.
Opposed to being almost the exception that proves the rule. And we will, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll come back with my little bit more jaundiced take on this thing. But we have a lot to discuss with this. We'll be back in just a moment. So, Heather, in the first segment, we were talking about your piece in Salon.com, where you had sort of compared, or just maybe checked in on, where we have come since 1991. It was that Rodney King was chased by the police for a DUI and taken out of his car and just beaten horribly. And it was caught on videotape at a time where, you know, and in fact, I was working in video at that time, doing comedy back in Boston. And the video cameras that we had were quite large, and they were just not, they were not, you know, remotely as ubiquitous as they are now, obviously, on people's phones. And the relationship between seeing something on video and being able to contextualize it into what real life is still, I think, was certainly wasn't where it is now. And you made that point that the woman who videotaped this really got in there and captured what was going on in a way that made it impossible to interpret what was happening between Chauvin and Floyd in any differently than it actually was. One of the things that I feel like I was a little troubled by the reaction that we saw from like a broad swath of people to the ruling and the verdict. And it was certainly, I'm a little hesitant to celebrate anybody going to jail and to celebrate, like,
right, of course,
like the bottom, you know, like the least amount of thing that should have happened for someone who killed another person. I certainly can understand the relief and the sense of, like, at least there's some accountability in this moment. But, one to keep in thing to keep in mind is, when the DA, the Minneapolis DA, wrote up what happened there, it is very different from, in, well, I should say, different enough in key significant ways from when the Attorney General of the state, Keith Ellison, was appointed by Governor Tim Walz to write up the same incident.
Mm-hmm.
There was all sorts of small sort of like trajectory shifting descriptions of what had led up to that moment and what had happened in that moment in the DA report that could have very well led to a defense that Chauvin was, that Floyd was asking for it, that there was no indication that Chauvin had that Floyd was dying, that maybe, you know, that Floyd's behavior was erratic in such a way that Chauvin wasn't being irresponsible in the way that he was dealing with him. And the fact is that there are not more than a handful of Keith Ellisons,
right?
Even a handful in this country. So this is not, this is no reflection on any type of systemic change. It is one person was in the right place at the right time to deal with this. And it's quite possible, and we've certainly seen it in Kentucky and in Missouri. We can see attorney generals coming in and, you know, not doing what Keith Ellison did. And then, aside from that, important fact that this is not a reflection on a change, a systemic change. And you read reporting in Axios saying that this verdict took a little pressure off of lawmakers in Washington to do anything. We saw Joe Biden back off on a national police commission, even though the DOJ is going to go in Minneapolis. But, you know, we've seen that before. There needs to be a wholesale reform is almost too small of a world. Reimagining of what it means to have police function in this society. And, you know, you look at what Nancy Pelosi's response was that somehow, and I'm sorry, you know, like, there was only really two or three possible outcomes from that trial. She is the Speaker of the House. I imagine this was a planned speech or response. And if it wasn't, then it should have been because she expressed, said that, phrased it as George Floyd sacrificed himself for justice. And first off, not only is it a sort of an offensive thing to say that George Floyd sacrificed himself, he didn't sacrifice anything. He did not make this was not his choice.
Right.
That is a big part of the point, is that he didn't sacrifice anything. He would not have made this choice consciously. And then the idea that he sacrificed it for justice, that end of the equation is also wrong. There was no justice here. There was accountability, but there's been no change. It's not going to impact the way that the police react to the next George Floyd or anything like that. None of that has happened. There's a certain amount of accountability, but certainly the police know we don't have a AG Ellison in our state, so we don't have to worry about that. Mm-hmm. And I found that problematic. I found, Brian Williams on MSNBC said something to the effect of, like, he hopes that these protesters go into policing and can change the policing community. We need a structural change in the way that police relate to people in general, but specifically black and brown people in this country. And that means we need to cut down on the amount of reasons armed police have to have contact with people. Period. There's really no other way to approach this. And, it's one thing I understand that, like, you know, sort of the mainstream is going to be behind where, and I think in your piece, you cited a guy who was involved in the LA riot saying, like, the difference is that there's more people who are not black, essentially, who are allied with us. And I think there's certainly, I think that's the case amongst the population, but it is not the case, it seems to me, that there is a real genuine understanding within the I don't know what you call it, the elite, the establishment, the conventional wisdom, the power brokers, the people who drive the narrative in this country. There is an understanding that there's a problem, but I don't think they understand the scope of the problem. And they're still, like, reliant on the idea that maybe we get a couple of good, we get a good ruling here and we have a good person working there. And I think that's the problem. We've got a lot of work to do as a society. And we just have a minute here. I think this is a good first step, but it will be one of those moments that lets the air out of the tire in a really unfortunate way if we don't see something more structural that is repaired here.
Well, I think you're right. It could let the air out of the tire, certainly among the establishment. Those things you cite, you know, are absolutely appalling, really. I mean, just kind of show a total lack of sort of, as you say, understanding of where we're at. And then you had the right wing, of course, and there's a lot of those people saying that, you know, Chauvin, that the trial was rigged and that the jury was, you know, Tucker Carlson saying that the jury was afraid, so they had to find him guilty. Implications across the board that he didn't deserve to be convicted, which is completely stunning. And I don't think most people agree with that, but you do have a large faction in this country who follow that stuff and who believe it. So that's a bad combination there that you have, where you have this strong pushback from the right, and then you have this wishy-washy middle of the road, just kind of wanting to sweep it under the rug. And, you know, the thing is that it shouldn't take this effort. George Floyd got, you know, Chauvin got convicted. It took a worldwide protest for months.
Yes.
Of people everywhere. I mean, the effort it took to get to that point, to make that understanding was huge. You can't have that. Although I think those people in the streets, they're going to be back. They're not giving up. And that's the part that I think is the hopeful part, is that I really think activism has been activated.
Well, I think you're right about that. As always, Heather Parton, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Now, Emma Vigeland, my colleague. Emma, take it away. What do you have for us this week?
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo is attempting to deflect from a series of scandals and alleged cover-ups. And in this case, the deflection is largely good, marijuana legalization. But the question of who will benefit most from this decision still remains. Our next guest, Matt Stieb, associate editor and writer at the New York Magazine, joins me to discuss his piece detailing New York State's move towards marijuana legalization and specifically who profits. Matt, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
Yeah. Hi, Emma. How are you?
I'm doing all right. So let's start broadly. Estimates show that legal cannabis will generate over $4 billion in revenue for the state. You know, if I were dictator of New York, this would have been a no-brainer. I would have done this so long ago. So that begs the question, why now? How did the state legislature get this done, given Cuomo's opposition in the past?
Yeah, so Cuomo has been opposed to marijuana legalization from about 2013, when it started to get into the national conversation, to about 2019, when he fully came around. A lot of that was due to New York specific politics. He is known as someone who likes to control everything in Albany. So he reportedly supported a group of Democrats who broke off as a faction and caucused with Republicans so that he could have more power. So the word dictator that you used is interesting. It's not quite there, but there's power.
The IDC, right? Yeah. So do you want to just expand for our listeners and viewers what the IDC was?
Sure. So I'm not quite sure exactly when it began, but it ran until the 2018 midterms when everyone was unelected. And there was a group of moderate Democrats throughout the state who kind of broke off to join the Republicans with the vote so that in the state Senate, there wouldn't be a Democratic majority. So there was, the assembly was run by Democrats, but the state Senate wasn't. So it created this environment in which Cuomo was able to kind of dictate the terms of what sort of legislation would get passed and what sort of things were working. That ran out in 2018 when Democrats voted out the five remaining members of the IDC. And at that point, there was a state Senate majority and a state assembly majority. So come 2019, you know, it was in the cards to say, okay, this is going to get legalized, but it still wasn't there. A couple efforts didn't really get over the goal line. In 2020, the state Senate got a supermajority. So, you know, are able to dictate basically the law. You can't overturn that supermajority from the Republican side. So combining that supermajority in the Senate with the assembly control and Cuomo's recent political crises, which are related to his alleged misconduct, as well as his office's alleged moving around of numbers to make it sort of cover up the deaths during the beginning of the pandemic in nursing homes. So you put those two things together in an impeachment inquiry and an investigation from the state attorney general into the nursing home thing. That's a lot of power that is now gone. So with that new calculus of what you can do, they did this marijuana legalization bill, as well as taxing the millionaires in New York, adding two new tax brackets for big earners, and then also legalizing sports betting on phones, so stuff like FanDuel, which, you know, the three of those things in like 3 weeks, pretty crazy.
Yeah, as a admitted sports gambler, this is not good for my pocketbook, but I digress. I'm very excited about it. I'm also enthusiastic about just justice and cannabis legalization in this instance, because it's you know, New York is a very blue state, and it's well past time that New York legalized marijuana. So some people are saying that New York's law doesn't go far enough, but a lot of what you wrote about shows that it is more progressive than other states. There's still some things that could be improved for sure and don't go far enough in many instances. But can you expand on some of the provisions that progressives might be happy with, including the 40% reinvesting number in communities that have been hurt by punitive drug policies? Can you touch on that and other elements of the law?
Sure. So, you know, New York was pretty late getting to the table on this. I think either 2012 or 2013 is when the first states, Colorado and Washington, were able to do it. But the fact that they came so late to the table, or able to learn from a lot of unintentional mistakes or misses on other laws. And that's really where this success is, not the fact that New York is legalizing, but the way it is legalizing. So this law, for tax revenue from selling weed, there will be 40% of it returns to communities that have been disproportionately damaged by the war on drugs. The other 40% will go towards education. And I think the remainder is still being figured out exactly where that goes. But Crystal Peoples Stokes, who is the sponsor of the bill in the assembly, said that, you know, this is a lot more than raising revenue. It's about investing in the lives of the people that have been damaged. And, you know, from that 80%, that's clear that, you know, those aren't just words. They're putting that money, that revenue, towards people who've been hurt. And at the same time, you know, there is a pretty significant dent or hole to fill in the New York budget. So they could move that money elsewhere, but by passing those other measures, and they're able to, you know, put teeth in this thing in a way that other states haven't. Another big aspect of it is that all criminal charges or convictions that took place prior to legalization that are now legalized, any act of possession or small sales is now expunged from a record, which is a big deal for someone who's applying for a loan or for school or job or something like that. And then the third element that I see looking through this that is separates New York is what they're calling like a social equity applicant program. So people who are disabled, people of color, people who have been arrested or have had family members arrested are able to apply and access 50% of the dispensary licenses, which, you know, half of the market is a lot. And in other states, you've seen these attempts happen, but they don't quite get over the goalposts because economically, it's still very difficult to get into the marijuana business. Banks don't actually loan. I think there's like 400 banks in the US who would do it. But, you know, if you're a federally chartered bank, you're not going to loan to a business that is selling something that is scheduled as a class one drug, along with LSD and MDMA and a few others. So that's, yeah, so that's difficult. And with this social equity program, there's something called an incubator loan program. So there's going to be a lot of terms here, but the medical marijuana dispensaries that are already operating are all big players. They're called multi-state operators, and they're mostly billion-dollar companies. Some of them are publicly traded, and they are going to want to expand into the expand their medical access and their recreational stuff as well. So when they're doing that, they're going to be hit with a nice tax, and that tax is going to go towards this loan program that is going to be able to provide money, either no interest or low interest, I'm not sure which, that people will be able to use to actually get this business going, because it's a lot of overhead. You have to get the lease, and you have to staff it and buy marijuana to sell, and between all these things, in other states like Massachusetts and Illinois, they've made these attempts to have social equity programs, and they have fallen short, where New York has appeared to learn from these things and for the better.
Yeah, I want to return to some of the lessons learned from states like Massachusetts and Illinois in a little bit, but I'd love if you could expand on the equity protections that essentially protect upstart companies in the state from these already large multi-state big marijuana retail businesses. So essentially already established marijuana firms, they're going to be limited in their ability to open dispensaries, right? So that there's a cap on it, as opposed to Florida, which I believe you cite in your piece, where it seems like there was no cap and it's all you know, free open market, and these big companies can just come in and buy up the whole industry in the state after they've legalized. And that's not necessarily the case in New York, right?
Right. Yeah. In other states, you've had that. There's one large firm that I spoke with called Curaleaf, and they had 37 dispensaries in Florida, which, you know, Florida has a lot of people, but if you have 37 dispensaries in a medical market, you're not going to be able to access it unless you have this huge capital to really break in. New York, it's limited to 8 dispensaries. Those are all medical for these big firms that are already in the medical market. And then 3 of them, in addition to those 8, they'll be able to have 3 recreational stores like attached to them. They're not sure if it's going to be actually in the store or attached or whatever, but so that's a limit of 8, which cuts down on the,
I'm sorry, just one quick question. So they will be siloed, these medical and recreational facilities. You can't go into a medical marijuana dispensary as a recreational user and buy it. That's going to be a very different, distinct situation.
Yes, they will be different. I think medical now is allowed to make stuff a little stronger than the recreational market. And so there will be 2 distinct markets. And which kind of makes sense, because if you're accessing it for that medical reason, you have to get a license and apply, where this for recreational, it's as soon as you're 21, you can go to the store and get it. So those protections are in there to kind of limit the big operators. And then for smaller operators, you can apply for all sorts of different applications, which, you know, either at the license level to sell or for distribution or to grow it. And so there's going to be a lot of opportunity to hop in at a marketplace that makes sense. And I spoke to one person who's been selling weed for about a decade. And, you know, a few years ago, I talked to him and he said he'd interested in, you know, breaking in once it's legal. And I asked him if sort of it's having all these big operators in the game is scary, or if there's going to be a concern like that. He said, no, it seems like there's enough space for everyone to be able to get in. If you want to and have the know-how and you know, access to some money, that you can get there. And again, by providing access to money through these loan programs, then it does open it up in a real way.
Certainly. I mean, the obstacle that you point out about how these larger operations have access to capital in the way that, you know, and because these banks are not providing it when they're federally chartered, this does offset some of that, but after we break, I want to get into whether or not it is sufficient. So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll dive even more into New York's marijuana legalization law. So when we went to break, we were discussing the measures that New York State took in order to allow for regular people, startups essentially, to come into the marijuana industry after, you know, it's been legalized in the state. But the problem still remains, even though they set up these loan programs to help out smaller growers, smaller businesses. What are some of the obstacles that are still in place, even though New York seemed to learn from mistakes of the past that other states made in their legalization efforts?
Yeah, I mean, there is this incubator loan program that we talked about, and the social equity protections and the 50% of applicants for the social equity program. Still, the access to capital is sort of restricted. This industry is largely funded by venture capital. And if you look at who venture capital is giving money to, it is mostly white applicants. There was a study in 2019 that of VC-backed businesses, around 1% were Black owned and just under 2% were Latino owned. So if you are in this industry, you know, it's hard to break this wheel that's been going for so long. There's also angel investment, which is a common source of funding, which is also going to tend to support white people because the racial wealth gap in the United States is so large. And, you know, largely if a white applicant is going to know, or perhaps some people who are able to fund in a way that a Black or Latino applicant may not. So that's sort of a societal level thing that this doesn't reach. There's another concern on the criminal level that while you're able to smoke weed in public to a certain extent, you know, you can't do it at parks or bars, but you can on the street. You're not able to in front of federally funded public housing, which seems like a situation that police might use to continue to crack down on people of color, which in New York City has been very significant. I think 94% arrests in 2020 were for marijuana arrests were of people of color.
That is a seemingly designed, I guess, stopgap in order to keep criminalizing Black and brown people in New York. I mean, that's a very odd provision to put in place. You know, if you can smoke weed on the street, you can smoke weed on the street. I mean, what was their reasoning there? Because it seems incredibly racialized despite the other progressive and restorative elements in the bill.
Yeah, it does feel racialized. My understanding is that because this is federally funded housing and run by HUD, that you're not going to be able to, there would be like a jurisdictional issue versus the state versus federal legality. So that is a concern. Now, in 2019, New York did pass a law that would end, prior to 2019, if you had a marijuana conviction, you were no longer eligible to live in federally funded public housing. So that has been removed. So there has been some steps to make progress there. But at the same time, this aspect of the law feels like it didn't quite get over the table. Or over the line. Now, one concern that is good is that weed will no longer be, or the smell of weed will no longer be able to use as a pretext for arrest, which has been used pretty significantly in New York to arrest people of color, who again are the majority or the large majority of arrests in New York. And as of 2017, marijuana arrests were the number one reason for, you know, like a misdemeanor arrest, despite possession being decriminalized since 1977 for a small amounts of marijuana, which is less than, I think 7/8 of an ounce was the 77 number, which is still a lot of weed. You know, an eighth is what is the small purchase amount. So there's been a lot of protections that have been ignored for arrests over the years. And this seems like an area in which it could continue.
So, is the loan program sufficient in order to fund, like, is there a cap on how much money a person of color or someone who had been impacted by these laws, if they're able to access this loan and they meet all the criteria, is there a cap on how much money they get from the state? Because I would imagine that even though this is an effort to limit the influence of venture capital on this situation, on the marijuana industry in New York, that they would have funds that would far exceed whatever the state could provide.
Yeah, that's a detail. There are many details that have yet to be figured out. The legislation has passed, and there's a 5-member board split between the Assembly, the Senate, and the governor, who determines how these statutes are going to come out. And I spoke to some lawyers and some marijuana justice advocates, and they said that, you know, the law is great, and for the most part, a lot of it is going to be dictated in the next 12 to 18 months as they figure out what is actually going to happen. So that amount is going to be figured out later. But it does seem like these large marijuana firms are going to be able to get into the market through these other ways, although there's that limit on dispensaries and will be mostly restricted to the medical market. Recreationally, the one firm I spoke to called Curaleaf, they intend to sell to smaller firms. They have a similar equity program where, you know, applicants are going to apply, and then they will loan out, you know, they're going to, it's funny. They're going to basically front weed to them, which is a good opportunity to, get the market going, but also make a decent money on the side, and then have a business relationship and a contact moving forward. So this is a place where it seems like a large marijuana company can grow and sell. And at the same time, the state needs them in a way, because they're going to be on day one, whenever the legal sales is, whether it's 12 or 18 months, you want to have a store open right away so that illicit market isn't there anymore. Right now, it's kind of in a weird gray area that weed is legal, but sales is not. So, you don't want to be in that gray area for too long. So being able to stand up a dispensary on day one is important.
Can you expand on this board that the state is commissioning to basically oversee this rollout?
Yeah. So it's called the Cannabis Control Board. There's 5 members. At least one will be dictated from the governor's office, from the Senate, and the Assembly each. And then I think 2 might actually come from the governor and 2 from those legislatures. And the other one is sort of a consensus vote, which the Senate has like a potential veto over. So they're going to be determining the statutes of, you know, everything from how many dispensaries there are to how many dispensaries can be in a certain place, which are 2 of sort of the biggest concerns that they have moving forward. If you have a ton of dispensaries, you know, that's a lot of opportunities to sell and to get into this market. And, you know, same with the growing licenses and the distributors licenses. And one thing we haven't touched on yet, that New York also has cafes. You know, you won't be able to sell alcohol, but you'll be able to smoke in a cafe, which is not something that's common among other states who've legalized. But if there aren't a small amount of licenses for all these things, and they become more valuable, and generally a higher bidder is going to be able to access them, which, you know, even if it's a 50% 50% of the applicants are the social equity program, it's still going to like rise to the top within that community. So it is difficult to see where that's going to happen based on what we know now of the number.
I didn't even realize that about the cafes until talking to you. And I believe I'd heard about it, but that's a very interesting development. It makes it a lot more European, I think.
Yeah, it is interesting coming out of the pandemic, because or at least in New York City, where so many storefronts have closed, and you know, this is an opportunity to sell something that people want to buy. So it's hard to determine, or it could be something that has a big storefront presence pretty fast if people like it. You know, if you can buy weed and smoke outside and that's what's preferred, and then, you know, maybe it won't succeed as much, but we'll find out.
Yeah, I mean, I'm the wheels are spinning in my mind just about the marketing opportunities. In order, all of these businesses have shuttered, as you say, and you could basically create this new age version of a bar, except with marijuana, and let's hope private equity doesn't completely buy all of that up as well. But I digress. So I wanted to ask about the failures in Massachusetts and Illinois to curb racial disparities in their marijuana rollout. Can you talk a little bit about that and how those states and their experiment informed? I know you touched on it a little bit, but expand on how that informed New York's law.
Mm-hmm. I'm not super caught up on Illinois, but I can go for Massachusetts. So great. Massachusetts legalized, and part of the law was that local towns and cities were able to determine whether or not they wanted to have dispensaries within the town. So when they were doing that, you had to get a license with the town and with the state. So this created, while you're able to get a state license, you had to, you know, have real estate, and you're getting all the gears forward, and then the town will have a limited amount. So the town essentially sold off to the highest bidder. And so even though you were able to get everything off, if you didn't have the equity to, or the cash to do so, you weren't going to be able to get a license in the town. So in a lot of places, you know, outside of Boston and where there were a lot of access, it didn't quite work out to have the social equity programs that were supposed to be designed really play out on the ground. And I think 2 years after legalization first happened, there weren't any dispensaries owned by people of color. So this was attempted to be rolled out, and then they missed. And then New York saw this, and individual towns and cities were able to have some sort of determination of where dispensaries can go. You know, obviously they're not going to be near schools, and they'll be able to decide, cater to the town of where they're going to go to a certain extent, but there won't be that double license approach, and you will only have to get it with the state. So that appears to be a way in which you're kind of learning from previous failures of states that had good intentions. You know, there are other states where especially earlier states that got into a medical market. Florida's one, Oklahoma. I spoke to one advocate that was considered sort of the Wild West of this legalization, or for the medicalization at least. And in New York, it looks like they've learned in that sense.
Is that the consensus among activists? Is that, or advocates, I should say, that New York is, New York's legislation is more progressive and thoughtful about these issues than what we've seen previously?
Yeah, I think because of the sort of political environment that we were talking about earlier, and being late to the game and learning from previous mistakes, it is. I've spoke with someone from the Drug Policy Alliance, which works from a policy level and a public health level for laws for drugs across the board, not just marijuana. And they were pretty happy with how it worked, and worked with the sponsors of the bill in the Senate and the Assembly to get it over the line in a way that was progressive and able to enforce. And there are other states who are doing it well. Virginia just passed, and they moved it up from 2025 when things were going to roll out on the ground to 2021. And it looks like it'll be a pretty progressive opportunity there. New Mexico just passed this year as well. And it looks, I'm not familiar with the contours of the law, but it looks also like it's going to be a pretty progressive one. So as we continue to move forward in marijuana legalization at the state level, it looks like it's going to continue to be, the laws are going to learn from each other and be better than they were, say, a decade ago. But it's interesting because at the same time, at the federal level, it doesn't seem like there's going to be a lot of momentum at the moment, at least. Chuck Schumer, right after the New York bill was turned into law, he put forward something in the Senate saying, you know, this is the time, let's get it going, we have momentum. The Biden administration is not interested. You know, they have a lot of priorities related to the pandemic and inequality and infrastructure that they are trying to put forward now. And while this could easily be seen as something within that, you know, push to end inequality or reduce inequality, it's not a priority. They just fired a lot of, or I'm not sure how many staffers, but fired staffers who self-reported marijuana use in the past, despite, you know, the vice president doing so on the campaign.
Well, you know, given Biden's history, it's not terribly surprising. And, you know, just studying some of the arcane rules of the Senate, the Byrd rule, for example, you know, things need to pay for themselves and reconciliation, all of that. This could be a really easy way for there to be revenue generated in order to pay for some robust social programs in our country. Matt Steeb, associate editor and writer at New York Magazine, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
That's it for another week of Ring of Fire. Are you still subscribed to the free show? Well, head over to rofpodcast.com. Support the show, get extra content by becoming a member. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. And don't forget, check out my daily show, The Majority Report. Head over to majority.fm for my daily live stream covering all the biggest news stories of the day. For Emma Vigeland, Heather Parton, I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire.